You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 6th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Gary Gerstel, professor of American history at the University of Cambridge, author of The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, America and the World in the Free Market Era. Also on the program today, U.S. sees a dozen mass shootings over the weekend, three dead and 11 injured in Philadelphia, gunmen still at large. Meanwhile, the police story in Uvalde still unraveling as the House will vote on multiple gun control measures this week. Also this week, the January 6th primetime hearings start Thursday evening. In anticipation, Trump advisor Peter Navarro arrested for contempt of Congress. They put the cuffs on him. It's horrible. Dr. Oz, declared winner of the Pennsylvania Republican primary race for a Senate nominee. Meanwhile, Democratic nominee Fetterman recovering from untreated heart condition. Still not on the campaign trail yet. Primaries tomorrow in California, Iowa, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota. Well, and San Diego. Chesa Boudin is facing a recall vote in San Francisco. He is the reform district attorney, or attorney general, I guess, in San Francisco. Russia hits Kyiv with missiles. Biden excludes Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua from the Summit of Americas. And AMLO skips in response. Who's left? Boris Johnson faces no confidence vote. Starbucks closing a recently unionized Ithaca store in what most people perceive as obvious retaliation for the unionization that is spreading across the country at Starbucks stores. Meanwhile, Earth hits record high of CO2 levels. That's a bad thing. And pro-choice polling is also at a near record high. That's a good thing, but it won't matter nearly as much as those CO2 levels, sadly. All this and more on today's Majority Report. It is Monday, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us at the beginning of the week. Joining me, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
Let's not get into it. I know you had a rough night last night.
The night was okay because they played in the afternoon, so it gave me a little bit of a chance to recover.
There you go. Rangers lost right at the end, too, is my understanding, so yeah. It's a little bit painful.
Odd that you, paid attention to this. Usually you don't know, but you've mentioned it a few times to me, rubbing it in my face. Loss? Yeah, right.
It's just a way for me to feel better about the Celtics losing so badly last night. Misery loves company. Let's go to this. There's a late breaking story that is out now of something that I think we could see coming from the very beginning. And in fact, I just thought that that Elon Musk's whole charade would have fallen apart after the fact, frankly. The idea that he was going to revolutionize Twitter, whatever that means. It seems that Elon Musk has gotten cold feet, as it were. But here is Joe Biden on Friday saying that responding to Elon Musk's feelings about the U.S. economy. Now, well, let's play this clip and we'll talk about that for a moment.
Elon Musk has said that he has a super bad feeling about the U.S. economy going up 10%. You say Elon Musk about his feeling about the economy. Jamie Dimon has said similar things.
Well, let me tell you, while Elon Musk is talking about that, Ford is increasing their investment overwhelmingly. I think Ford is increasing the investment in building new electric vehicles, 6,000 new employees, union employees, I might add, in the Midwest. The former Chrysler Corporation, Stellantis, they are also making similar investments in electric vehicles. Intel is adding 20,000 new jobs for making computer chips. So, lots of luck in his trip to the moon. I mean, I don't.
It was just like a great moment for him. You got to give him credit.
Got to give him credit for that. Now, there is, they cited Jamie Dimon. There are other, like, finance bankers who are worried about.
Jamie's a friend.
Worried about the economy. And, you know, who knows? I definitely think what happens, though, and particularly with Elon Musk, who seems to be really increasingly revealed as a guy you look at and you just wonder, how does he tie his shoes? And then you realize, well, probably slip-ons. But
someone's paid to tie them
exactly.
For him. Yeah.
But there's a lot of – it doesn't take more than a Jamie Dimon for a certain percentage of really rich people to go, there's something wrong with the economy, and then sort of backfill in the reasons. There very well may be. We're living in a very, very strange time where you have, near record low unemployment. We just had great employment numbers for last month. We're having there's upward wage pressure. There is also at the same time some measure of inflation and price gouging, and we have problems with supply lines. So it really is unclear, but that is an important response, even though it doesn't necessarily address possible concerns with the economy. Although, frankly, that's above my pay grade as to what's going on. I think that's true with frankly, a lot of people. But Elon Musk should not be part of this conversation is the bottom line. And or at the very least, he could be talking about it, but nobody should be asking the president about it any more so than someone should say, you know, Sam Cedar said this on the Majority Report the other day. What do you think about that? Like, Biden's response should be similar.
He treated it.
Good luck with the next Celtics game or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Hope your kid's little league team works out. He should. That type of disregard of Elon Musk is exactly what this society needs more of.
Totally. And another thing that I feel like is not making headlines with that response there is he mentioned the union jobs that are being created, right?
Right.
That was part of that statement there by the electronic vehicles being manufactured by Ford and other automakers. So there are two rhetorical flourishes that he used there, or at least, you know, themes that I think are helpful for him and Biden should do more of. One, going after billionaires, and two, talking positively about unions.
And the Ford building electronic cars and other companies, that's really a problem for Elon, because Tesla's stock, like a lot of tech stocks, is basically pumped up as a future monopoly play. And as it becomes clear that that isn't going to happen, it becomes a lot darker for Elon.
We had this conversation, I don't know what it was, 6 months ago about this. It's like the idea that Elon Musk was going to set up proprietary charging stations around the country. And that's one of the reasons why he was against Build Back Better. Because even though every single thing that his business success has been built upon has come from government largesse, tax breaks, tax subsidies, development of technologies that he's incorporated in the context of his cars, which I am all for. We should have more of that. But what inevitably you see people like Elon Musk doing at that point is trying to shut the door behind him.
Yeah.
And the idea that the U.S. government would create charging stations around the country would simply open up the ease into the transition of electric vehicles by other manufacturers, for like the big ones, Ford, GM, and then Toyota, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he doesn't want that, of course, because he wants a monopoly. And then what he does is he starts saying, I'm worried about the economy and the wokeness.
And he's worried about other things. Like, I mean, he's worried about that dynamic for sure. One, that's why he's calling out Biden publicly. But two, that's why he does these stunts. He's the PR stunt billionaire. He loves trying to get himself into headlines because that's what he thinks creates more investment and gets people more hyped about Tesla. That's what this whole debacle was.
Right.
But it's falling apart before his eyes because he's not smart.
And now he's basically written a letter to Twitter saying, I'm going to scrap the deal because as far as I can tell, what he's basically admitting is, I forgot to ask, do you guys have a bunch of bots? Like, do you have as many accounts as, like, it says on your, publicity page? On the I did my due diligence by going to the about page on Twitter.com. And I'm starting, it occurs to me, maybe I should ask about how many bots you have.
Yeah, Elon, it's every single person that said they like the Tesla truck.
Exactly. All those bots. But, of course, he's going to back out of this deal because it was going to be a crap show for him to own this thing, which is why I kept saying call his bluff. And he realized I better fold this hand before somebody actually does call my bluff.
Well, I mean, the Tesla stock has taken a dip because of this. So now he's trying to pull the escape hatch. Hopefully it's too late. Fingers crossed.
You know, who's also really happy about this is Donald Trump, because now he doesn't have to come back onto Twitter or have to be faced. Now he doesn't have to be unbanned from Twitter is really what the point
is. I always believed in Truth Social.
I can't. It's if I had been unbanned, where's the aggrievement? All right. We're going to be hear from our sponsors, and then we'll be talking to Gary Gerstle, who's written The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, America and the World in the Free Market Era. But first, speaking about the free market, Shopify. That is a it's really your own little free market on the on your website,
actual one.
Exactly. If you run a business, you realize that you need knowledge about your sales. You need knowledge as to where the sales are coming from. All the things that a business person does that we don't do around here, frankly. But we do use Shopify, and we use it for our merch shop, and it has been super easy to use and set up. We can add merchandise. We can take it down. We can get records of what and data as to what we're selling and when, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the amazing thing about Shopify. It grows with you. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources that were once reserved for big businesses. So it doesn't matter if you're an upstart or you're a startup or if you're an established business. Doesn't matter if you're a podcast that sells merch on the back end. Shopify, folks like that can sell everywhere. They can synchronize their online and in-person sales. Well, let's say we start doing a lot of like live shows and I need to synchronize our merch sales.
That'd be fun.
That would be fun. Shopify powers millions of businesses from first sale to full scale. You can reach customers online. You can reach them across social networks. They have a ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. Includes Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, more. Plus, you gain insights as you grow to give you detailed reporting conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. Like I say, it's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. You can go through all of it. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify, shopify.com/majority. Folks, I know you get tired sometimes. You push your body too hard. Saul was out there this weekend, 2 baseball games. I'm not going to brag about what he did, but I got to keep him hydrated. How do I do it? I fill up a bottle of water, and then I add some liquid IV. Actually, technically, the way I do it is a little bit of water, liquid IV, shake it, then more water. But people,
well, it's the wrong way. I put the liquid IV in first and then the water.
Yeah, but it's better to do it the way I just did it. It doesn't matter. One stick of liquid IV hydration multiplier in 16 ounces of water hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, liquid IV comes in flavors that you'll like, your kids will like, watermelon, lemon lime, strawberry, pina colada, and more. Today, I have the tangerine, the immunity booster. They also have the green energy drink. I mean, all of Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. You get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. And the reason why I like to give it to my kid as opposed to letting him get, you know, sort of those traditional sports drinks, Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients. It is non-GMO. It is free from gluten, dairy, and soy. The science of cellular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company has donated over 20 million servings globally. Liquid IV, great if you're going out playing Little League Baseball or if you're going out and coaching Little League Baseball, but also great if you're traveling, if you've been maybe had a little too much to indulge in. I mean, for me, it's every morning. That's how I get my hydration during this show. Grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, and you get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you use the promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today at liquidiv.com. Promo code MAJORITYREP. And lastly, one of the other things that I do on a daily basis, you might even call it a ritual at this point, is now I take a multivitamin. And which one do I take? Well, I want to know what I'm putting into my body and why. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in a bioavailable form so that your body can actually use it. You're not going to find any sugars, any GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, or artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule design makes taking your vitamins easy. Ritual delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help fill gaps in diet. No shady extras. They have stuff available for women. They have vitamins available for women, for men, and for teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. They got an over 51. I just take it just because, well, I'm over 50. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping. This is key for me because I have started many multivitamin regimens. My doctor says, yeah, you need more D3. You need this. And then I do it for a month, and then I completely forget. I run out, and then I forget to go to the supermarket, and that's it. This is beautiful because they send it to your door every month with free shipping. You can start, you can snooze, you can cancel your subscription at any time. If you don't love Ritual within your first month, they refund your first order. Super important to do, particularly if you're stressed, you're not eating well, and who isn't this time? Post-COVID or fake post-COVID, whatever era we're in. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your ritual today. That's ritual.com/majority. As always, all these links will be in our podcast and our YouTube descriptions. You can check it out there. Now I want to welcome to the program Gary Gerstle. He is a professor of American history at the University of Cambridge. He is the author of The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, America and the World in the Free Market Era. Gary, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglet.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you. You can hear me.
I can hear you. You sound great. And thanks for joining us. So let's start with And we've done, we have talked to many authors, some of whom you cite in your book, Slobodan and Slobodian. I may be mispronouncing his last name, but let's just start. I want to start first with a term that I believe that you coined. What is political order? What do we mean by this?
Political order is a term I use to help those of us who are interested in American politics think our way out of the 2-, 4-, and 6-year election cycles. Obviously, elections are important. They're critical, but they tend to suck up all the oxygen in the room as though the only thing that matters are the elections of presidents, off-year elections coming up in 2022. Some presidents are more important than others, and some deserve more attention than others. And other changes in American political life occur over longer stretches of time. And my concept of political order is meant to capture longer moves, longer tendencies in American politics. So, for example, I write and wrote about earlier the rise and fall of the New Deal order, the reforms associated with Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s and 40s. My point is that the New Deal matters not just because of the movement of and reform of the 1930s and 40s, but this movement became so authoritative, so powerful, that it compelled even the opposition party, the Republican Party, to play on its turf, to observe its principles. And this New Deal order lasted from the 1930s until the 1960s and early 1970s when it fell apart. And then the neoliberal order replaced it. And similarly, it was a movement that began with Republicans in this case rather than Democrats and became so powerful and authoritative that it compelled the opposition party, in this case the Democrats under Bill Clinton, to play on the Republican Party's turf. So an order is meant to suggest ways in which all players in American politics have to play by certain ideological principles. I became interested in how those formations take shape, how they gain power, and then how they fall apart.
And how do they, I mean, how when we talk about an order, and this is obviously a classification to understand a certain period of time, right? At what point is this self-fulfilling, or maybe at what point does this dominance take over? Like, is it how preordained is it? Like, once, and I know we're looking at this retrospectively, but and maybe I don't want to get ahead of myself in terms of talking about Clinton in the context of the neoliberal order, but let's talk about Eisenhower, let's say, in the New Deal. What where he basically has to sign on to this sort of New Deal thing in the air, as it were. What, how does that work? Like, where does this live? It's not just in the air. I guess, like, you know, like, what does it embody within our society at that time that would compel an Eisenhower? But it's not necessarily compel an Eisenhower. It also gives rise to an Eisenhower, right? Because it's the sort of like the waters that he's swimming in, or that anybody's swimming in, an Eisenhower is going to rise. There may have been other competition, but it's just because of the nature of the water, Eisenhower rises. So it's just not so much that it compels Eisenhower as much as it creates him in that instance, right? Will you just unpack that a little bit?
A very good question. It both creates and compels Eisenhower. It creates Eisenhower because political order generates a set of political beliefs that are so powerful, so authoritative, that anyone involved in politics feels compelled to take notice of it and make use of it. Now, Eisenhower was not the predestined man to be the Republican president of the 1950s. That was Robert Taft, senator from Ohio. And yet he was so out of step with the new deal mentality that especially in the early years of the Cold War, his star began to fall and Eisenhower's began to rise. But Eisenhower also is making political calculations. He says the Republican Party, 1952, has been out of power in the presidency for 20 years. How are we going to get it back? In order to get it back, he said, we have to play by some of the principles that the Democratic Party has established. And he writes a private letter to his brother at one point and says, I might want to abolish Social Security. I might want to abolish labor law, but if I do that, the Republican Party will never be heard from again in American history. That's the calculation. And yet you're right. He is also a creature of the New Deal. He did not oppose. He had high regard for the power of government. He, after all, was the man in charge of the most powerful institution of government that America had probably ever introduced, that being the World War II Army military that won one of the greatest victories in the history of America and the history of the world. He stood astride this. He commanded this huge bureaucracy. He could see what government can do if its force and power was unleashed and it could do good in the world. So he was serving under Democratic presidents. This was not foreign territory to him. This was familiar. He was himself, as you say, already something of a creature of the New Deal. And yet he's got a big set of constituencies to work with, both parties in America, because there's only two of them, have to encompass a lot of different points of view. So he also has to make calculations about what's going to get him elected and what's going to make the Republican Party a success again. So it's both in the air, something that helps him rise to the top, and it's also a set of calculations that he's making to restore the Republicans to power.
What makes, in the context of this concept of a political political order, what drives it? I mean, how much of it is the actions of the president or the legislature, or and how much of it is the context of the age and the history or the order that comes before it? I mean, where is it? What creates this air, I guess, this thing that's in the air?
It doesn't begin as an order. It begins as something else. It begins as something more modest, a movement of political organizations, groups, political parties, ideas, policy networks. When a political order is fully established, it's a very complex formation. It has constituencies. It has donors. It has policy networks. It has think tanks. It also has ideological principles, which have to generate broad support. It also has to demonstrate success. Success not simply in terms of getting people elected, but demonstrating as well that this party and with its ideas and its policy networks can generate a good life for an awful lot of Americans. And it has to sell Americans on the vision of the good life that it is offering. So it has all these elements to it, and you can have many elements present of a would-be, wannabe political order. There are many elements in place for a progressive Biden-Sanders political order, and yet it's not a political order, right? It has not got the authority or power to command victory or to command authority beyond districts of the Democratic Party itself. So one can discern in this current moment many elements of what I see as essential to a political order, and yet it is not yet a political order. It has to win at the polls. It has to convert victories in the polls into enduring support, durable constituencies. It has to deliver the goods, and it has to convince an awful lot of Americans that its core ideas are the rightfully dominant core ideas in American life, and they ought to give loyalty to it beyond simple calculations of gain and loss in particular elections.
Okay, and so before we get into sort of the rise of the neoliberal order, to me, the New Deal order comes out of crisis, right? I mean, it is coming out of the Great Depression, which creates a tremendous amount of crisis. The neoliberal order, does that come out of crisis, or is it just like, I mean, it seems, from my understanding of it, that it's more, on some level, a crisis that is not so widely shared, that the crisis is within certain sort of sections of our society, the wealthy. I mean, just sort of like corporate industrial crisis. But talk about that role of crisis and why did it exist in the rise of the neoliberal order, or was it you know, more or just it was a crisis that was not maybe as broadly shared.
Absolutely. It came out of crisis. Now, let me say one thing about the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was the single largest capitalist crisis in all of American history. And nothing that has happened since then can rival the magnitude of that crisis, the depth, the severity, the durability. But the 1970s was also a profound crisis affecting all of American life for a variety of reasons. There was racial conflict in America, which was pulling apart the New Deal order. There was a tremendously unpopular war, which also was wrecking the Democratic Party. And then there were profound changes in the international political economy of the 1970s, which profoundly unsettled the lives of tens of millions of ordinary Americans. And there were two in particular. One was the reemergence of industrial competitors to the United States and the world. From 1945 to 1972 or 73, American industry was alone preeminent. The rest of the world's industrial capacity and structure had been destroyed by World War II, literally so. And suddenly there are Japan and Germany and other industrial countries that have rebuilt their economies and are serious competitors to the U.S. In the 1970s are the decade when foreign cars begin to flood into the U.S. in ways that had been unimaginable 10 years earlier. And they threaten core manufacturing industries of American life, the pride of America, the car industry, the steel industry, all the other industries that depended on automobile manufacture. That's one very big change. The other big change is basic alterations between the relationship of the global north to the global south. And here I'm talking about commodity prices. The global north had built its economic recovery after World War II on the cheapest of energy prices. And this was especially true of petroleum. And Britain and America controlled everything about oil production in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. And the 70s are the moment in which the petroleum producing countries are declaring their independence. And petroleum prices, they get to choose the prices now. They go through the roof and they plunge what had been an affluent economy, delivering a good life to tens of millions of Americans. This was an economy dependent on the cheap flow of oil, not competition from other major industrial nations in the world. And suddenly the U.S. is battling on these different fronts. And it produces stagflation, with inflation and unemployment rising at the same time, something that was not supposed to happen, according to the economists who were serving the New Deal. So there was a serious recession. Tens of thousands of auto workers, steel workers, and others in basic industry were thrown out of work. The corporate America was thrown into crisis. But it was not just a crisis for corporate America. It was a crisis for corporate America. But the crisis spread throughout the United States, and it also becomes an urban crisis because these cities that have been dependent on manufacture, they're losing jobs, they're losing taxpayers, their tax base is shrinking. This is a moment when black and white workers are thrown into competition with each other. There's less welfare, there's less money for police, there's less money for governing cities. And so this also becomes a serious industrial urban crisis. The metropolitan centers of America are plunged into various forms of anger, resentment, disorder. So yes, the 70s are a very, very big crisis. And this is the moment when ideas that have been tucked away on the periphery, neoliberal ideas cultivated by certain individuals like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, but are utterly irrelevant in American politics. This is their moment. They are released from their marginality and they rush toward the mainstream.
Well, the thing that comes most to mind when you talk about the energy crises of the 70s is Carter's airline deregulation. I mean, can you draw a direct connection there with the instability of oil, energy crises, and the United States feeling less in control of that, and the forward momentum to larger deregulation, but the airlines in particular?
Yes, absolutely. It's a very interesting connection. until the crisis hits, the reigning economic orthodoxy, Keynesian ideas, was that you used government to regulate the economy, that capitalism left to its own devices was prone to chaos, misery for the poor. You had great faith in government that it could regulate the economy in the public interest. And airlines were heavily regulated. Trucking was heavily regulated. Telecommunications were heavily regulated. These were all part of the New Deal order, the settlement of the 1930s and 40s. And in the 70s, nothing is working. And so there are ideas out there, mostly in the Republican Party and mostly in the hands of neoliberals, who say the route to recovery for America is to get rid of all this regulation, to take the government out of the economy, to free the animal spirits of capitalism. This will solve problems having to do with high energy prices and other things. And Carter is a fence sitter. He's a transitional president. He doesn't quite know what to do. On the one hand, he inherits the New Deal and a belief in regulation. On the other hand, he says we got to try something different, and that something different becomes deregulation. And the widespread malfunctioning of the economy under the regulatory reach of a big, strong state is what encourages him to turn toward deregulation of airlines, of trucking, of AT&T, as a way of injecting some life into the American economy. The idea is government regulation is no longer working. Let's free entrepreneurs. Let's free industry. Let's free corporation. Let's free Southwest Airlines. Let's free People Express. I think you guys might be too young to remember People Express, but I remember their $19 flights from a little used airport, Newark, up into places like Rochester, New York. $19 a flight was a revolutionary act. Free up enterprise, because the government can no longer handle this. The government doesn't know what it's doing. Turn this over to the private sector. So this turning to the private sector and the unleashing the so-called virtue of the market, which is what neoliberalism is all about, occurs precisely in this moment of crisis. The ideas are not new. You mentioned Quinn Slobodian, and he has written very effectively and beautifully about these ideas being cultivated in Europe since the 1930s and 40s, making their way to the University of Chicago and other institutions. But until the crisis of the 1970s, they are not very relevant until American politics. So these packages of ideas are there. They're ready to be deployed. But it takes a crisis to release them from their marginality on the sidelines.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that is, I mean, there's sort of two separate stories here. One is sort of the broader story of how, you know, ideas hang around, and then the context is, you know, creates an opportunity for these ideas. And maybe they've also, the ideas have in many ways set their ducks up in a row, and they've been on the shelf just waiting, and then the opportunity strikes and these ideas grow. And then there's the story of the idea itself. I mean, let's just talk a little bit about that sort of the growth of the neoliberal, like where that ideas came from. We've talked about Mont Pelerin on the show quite a bit, and they sort of some of these figures, Hayek and others, came together to talk about where they should, you know, what they were worried about happening in the wake of World War II. Let's talk about that and start with the story of you write that the New Dealers basically appropriated the term liberalism from the old school classical liberals. And I laugh because of stuff that hopefully you don't even know about with some of these online right wingers who have used that construction in some way. But tell us about that in terms of like that so-called theft of the terminology, and then you know the nascent in the heart of what, and then I'll ask you to define neoliberalism.
Well, if we take the term liberalism back to the beginning, we're in the late 18th century, and it was it was, this is what I call classical liberalism, the original liberalism. And this liberalism sought to free markets from the heavy hand of government. And at that point, the heavy hand of government was monarchical government. It was aristocratic government. It was the heavy hand of the monarch who was making all economic activity serve his private purpose. It was aristocrats making economies in their regions enrich them without regard for the generation of wealth and the development of the economy for everyone. And so the original liberals, like the Scottish philosopher and political economist Adam Smith, say, remove these governments, these states, these impediments, allow people to truck, barter, and exchange as they would do making their own decisions. This is a free market philosophy. It carries with it a utopian promise that if you allow people to truck, barter, and exchange, to invest their money as they wish, to be the individuals they want to be, that good things will result and the unlimited potential of humanity will be released. Now, from a left point of view, this sounds like a lot of malarkey, but the point is, in the late 18th century, it was deeply and genuinely believed. This liberalism develops across the 19th century and early 20th century. It's often equated with laissez-faire. You get the government out of people's business. You let enterprise develop. You give individuals a chance to innovate. You give them a chance to develop new devices that are going to stimulate various kinds of production. This is the way to economic growth. And there was something right about that, because enormous powers and forces of economic growth were unleashed as a result of this. But the growth was unleashed in an extraordinarily chaotic, uneven, unequal way. So capitalist societies were growing by leaps and bounds under these liberal banners, but huge amounts of wealth was accumulating at one end and tremendous poverty and misery on the other. And so there emerges in the early 20th century a movement for a new liberalism, one that will guarantee people freedom, but one oriented to the freedom of the masses rather than the freedom of corporations. And when Roosevelt comes along in the 1930s, he says, the old liberalism is bankrupt. It has done nothing but enrich the wealthy. We are going to give you a new liberalism. And this liberalism is going to be about ordinary people enjoying their freedom. But what does it mean for ordinary people to enjoy their freedom? We must give them education. We must secure them against old age. We must give them medical care. We must help the casualties of industrial society. We must put individuals, we must limit the hours of work. We must raise the hours. We must raise the minimum wage. We must put people in a position to enjoy their freedom. And that requires strong government and a strong state in order for ordinary people to be free. This is positive liberty.
Can I interject one second here? Because, you know, I've done an interview that we haven't played yet about on a book called The Anti-Oligarchy Constitution. I wonder if, I mean, you know, and I, the, that reappropriation of freedom, and FDR talks about it with the four freedoms, and you know, the one can't live with, you know, one cannot fully actualize if one can't feed themselves and one can't, you know, have health care, and one could go on and on like this. But, is it as much of a theft as a reappropriation? Because, you know, Smith was talking about, when they say government in the 18th century, they're talking about the king. And if you, the idea that we're going to allow the people to decide for themselves, the question is, are we going to allow the people to decide for themselves as individuals who will ultimately go on to create their own little kingdoms? We'll call them corporations later, but or the people as a body and measure, you know, like there's like two forms of democracy, I guess, on some level that you could be talking about in the 18th century. And that is one where each individual is free from every other individual, or where individuals band together and are not and have a say as to who how they're going to organize their own society. We're going to elect people instead of, you know, deflecting to the king. So is FDR at that point sort of like grabbing that second tradition? I mean, to the extent that it was a tradition?
Yes. FDR would agree with you. He would say, I want you to speak for me. If we speak, we speak for each other. There are two forms of democracy. One, every individual gets to do what they want and keep everything they gather in the economy, no matter how rich and powerful they become. And the other vision of democracy and freedom is that people have the right to band together and to determine the circumstances under which they will be governed and what the government is going to provide in order to secure people's freedom. And the latter is what Roosevelt embraces. And he says, this is true liberalism, or I am being true to the original promise of freedom embedded in liberalism. The problem that he encounters, and the reason he's considered to be a traitor to his class, the gentry class from which he emerged, is that the promise of freedom for self-described liberals in the 19th and early 20th century hardens into laissez-faire, which means let markets do what they're going to do. Let corporations do what they want they're going to do. You cannot have government interfering with their rights because this is interfering with the rights of individuals. This had hardened into orthodoxy. This had hardened into an ideology that claimed liberalism as its own. And that is why Roosevelt, even as he's saying, I'm being true to the original spirit of liberalism, that is why his appropriation of liberalism is regarded as theft on the part of members of his own class, on the part of Herbert Hoover, his Republican predecessor, on the part of key elements of the Republican Party. They think that liberalism, as they understand it, has become their birthright, and Roosevelt has stolen it away. So they experience what Roosevelt has done as a form of theft. But what you're saying is what Roosevelt said at the time, which is he's saying, I'm being true to this original promise of freedom. And if you read his speeches from the 1930s, they're full of references to the Minutemen of the late 18th century and the revolutionaries who are bringing a new world into being. And he talks about eliminating Tories from the temple of capitalism, excommunicating them. He uses this 18th century language because he is persuaded that he is being true to that original promise of the American Republic. And large majorities of Americans agree with him and thus re-elect him in 1936 to one of the most overwhelming election mandates ever experienced by any president in American history. And of course, he's going to be re-elected two more times. The point is that the people like Herbert Hoover, people like Friedrich Hayek, later people like Milton Friedman, regard what Roosevelt did as a form of theft. They took the true ideology of liberalism, which is about individual freedom, corporate freedom, market freedom, and made it into something else, which they despised. And if you read what Hayek and Milton Friedman later say when people are trying to attach the label conservative to them, aren't you conservative? Aren't you conservative? Milton Friedman says, no, I'm not conservative. I'm liberal, but I can't call myself that because Roosevelt stole the term. And Hayek says the same thing. And that's why neoliberalism becomes an important term for them, because it's a way of distinguishing their desire to return to what they regard as a classical and true form of liberalism. And they can't simply call it liberalism because Roosevelt has stolen that for the Democratic Party for all time.
I would just call them retro feudalists, frankly. but I don't get to choose that. But so first, this neoliberal ideology at this point. Well, I guess now is a good time to sort of define that. But I think you've said, more or less, this is the idea that the markets are going to solve all, or nearly all of our problems, and they should be unencumbered by government intervention. And on some level, too, Hayek had this idea that there should be, that the government should be there to sort of facilitate this, too, right? Isn't there a quality of that the government exists really to sort of help industries rather than, and specific ones and specific entities? It's just that, I mean, there's a little bit of hide the ball here, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Where, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, can you just expand on that a little bit? And then let's talk about how it progresses through history.
Well, one way in which neoliberals sought to distinguish themselves from classical liberals was to say, yes, government intervention is generally bad, but there are strategic moments where government has to intervene to make sure markets are flourishing or to protect markets. And that is, there's a fudge factor there, because you might say, how can America talk about itself as a free market society in the late 19th and late 20th and early 21st century when it has this enormous military establishment run almost entirely by the government? To which neoliberals would say, well, if you ask what's the military doing, it's making the world safe for markets. And if it's making the world safe for markets, it's a legitimate activity. Now, neoliberals, self-described neoliberals today also say that this represents a new development in the history of liberalism, that classical liberalism did not depend on government in this way. But here they make a mistake, because we now know through all the good work that historians of 19th century political economy have done in the United States and elsewhere, that markets were never naturally occurring phenomena. They always had to be brought into existence and secured by government action, by law governing contracts, by rendering corporations into individuals that have the protection of property afforded to real individuals like you and me in the Constitution, tariffs, all kinds of other actions taken by the 19th century by government to strengthen markets and enable them to operate as they should. So markets do not go by themselves. They need a certain level of management. And so neoliberals are right to say that government intervention at certain points is crucial. They're simply wrong to think that this is a new element of liberalism. In fact, we can trace this all the way back to the late 18th and early 19th century. So what we might say is that liberalism and neoliberalism depend on a selective use of government.
Well, and doesn't that also put to lie the idea that this is a free market? Because this every now and then intervention, it's not like the American military is going to be agnostic in the way that it sets up these markets. It's not like the apparatus of capital is going to be agnostic in the interventions that are, however selective the neoliberals want them. They intervene on a specific side, and it's the side of capital, and it's the side of America. When we talk about it internationally, the TPP is a good example of this. Also, they intervene in a way that also insulates these markets from maybe what's going on amongst the vast majority of people, i.e. we're a little worried that, wages are going up. So it's time to sort of, pump the brakes, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, so the idea of a free market is in of itself a total fallacy. It's just a question of who gets to decide what constitutes a free market. For neoliberals, it's a free market if you ignore those interventions, which we pretend are agnostic interventions.
Well, it's largely true, but not entirely, because capitalism is a ceaselessly innovative system. And another word for innovation is destruction. And so all forms of wealth under a powerful capitalist system are often being destroyed and new ones are being created. And I think so we have to understand that sometimes markets are being set up to allow market activity to occur. So I think the idea that we can say free markets are completely a myth, or that there's nothing to a freely operating market abiding by certain rules, I would regard that as a mistake. And, you know, a case in point is the IT revolution that occurred in the United States. And if you think of how the IT revolution occurred and its various phases, there are some people who argue that everything about the IT revolution was made possible by government support during the Cold War, developing the initial computer systems and so on and so forth. And I would say, yes, that was crucial up to a point. But if we're to understand why the United States became the home to this industry and not the Soviet Union, then we have to recognize that there were opportunities created for innovation, technological advancement, allowing 10 or 15 different models of the personal computer to be invented to see which one would triumph in the end. And that, you know, the triumph of Steve Jobs and Apple was not preordained. It was not preordained that IBM was going to be sidelined. The kind of innovation associated with the social media company. In my book, I talk quite extensively about how a lot of this innovative zeal comes not from the right, but from the left. Steve Jobs was a tree hugging hippie at Reed College in the 1970s, and so were a lot of his hacker buddies. Now, at a certain point, if they're going to be successful, they have to, and they have a profound vision of personal freedom that they want to see encased in these machines, in this world of information freedom. If there had been no market opportunities, I think the United States would not have become the kind of home for this industry that it became. So there is a place for innovation. There is a place where competition thrives. Now we've seen what happens with that moment of innovation. We've seen these extraordinarily powerful technology and social media companies become the most powerful. The term you used earlier. Feudal is a good term to describe the private power that they exercise.
I would say
in the United States and the world,
where we definitely had freer freer markets, but I don't know if that constitutes free. And maybe I'm getting a little caught up on that word. But to me, it's like if I have a race, if I set up a horse race, and I put all the horses in there, I don't know who's going to win. But the fact that I've set it around, I've got barriers on the side, and I've made sure that people can't interfere. I mean, a free horse race could be just let's put six horses together and decide there's the finish line. Whatever happens, happens. People can run across. People can put obstacles in, but we don't do that.
Let's call them. What about if we call them organized markets?
I'm all for that.
In order for markets to function, they have to be organized. And I'm in total agreement with you about that. And I think the metaphor of the horse race is a good one. These have to be organized. They have to be run by certain rules. There has to be a sense of, for this to succeed over the long term, there has to be a sense of fairness among those who are competing. As we know with horse racing, the barriers to entry become higher and higher and higher as these markets develop further and further. But part of the thrill of horse racing is the outsider always at some, not always, but at certain moments being able to crash. And this is part of the history of capitalism, either outsiders, new centers of wealth, new kinds of entrepreneurs being able to crash the party and to doom older and more deadened forms of capitalism. So let us not underestimate the churn that capitalist societies
There's churn,
create,
but there is,
and that has to be facilitated by a certain kind of organized market.
And that organization has a politics to it. And there is, I mean, the churn can happen, but within the context of these political constraints, right? Like, I mean, yes. It's not going to help you if your horse can jump high. If I've decided there's no, we're not putting those jumps in this horse race. I get to choose within those horses. It could be any of these horses, but you obviously got to pay a lot of money to train them, et cetera, et cetera. But all right, I don't want to get too sidelined by that, because the argument that you make in the book is that Reagan sets the table, but Clinton comes in and does a lot of the neoliberal work, because neoliberalism by that time, by the time we get into the early 90s, has become dominant in terms of the political order, and the ballast of the existence of communism gets washed away. And I have to say, like, when I went into college in 84, I kept being told by my government professors, we've now seen a realignment in American politics. And on some level, that may have been their sense of something had fundamentally changed. I don't know if there was that concept of just how great the change was.
The end of history concept.
Well, that comes a little bit later, I think. But the idea that the Democrats aren't controlling things, they probably recognized the end of the New Deal order more than they could say where we were headed. But by the time Clinton comes in, that changes. Will you talk about how both the impact of the Democrats being dominated at that point by neoliberalism that had grown under Reagan and the loss of that ballast of communism?
Well, the loss of that ballast of communism is huge. I don't know whether your teachers in the 80s were talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union. I tend to doubt it.
No, because they were talking about just the 84 election, I think it was.
Yeah, because no one saw this coming. And if anyone tells you differently now, they're not telling you the truth. Because I was not just alive then. I was studying all these things. And everyone knew the Soviet Union as an empire was ailing, but no one expected it would disappear from the historical stage with the swiftness and finality with which it disappeared. This is not how empires leave the historical stage. They leave it slowly. They cling to the remnants of their power for as long as they can. Ottoman Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, they don't self-dissolve.
The U.S. right now.
Absolutely. The U.S. right now. You don't dissolve yourself. That's not how empires think. And with but we can talk about Gorbachev, the reformer, if you want to. I don't want to say more about him now because I don't think it's where you want to go. But Emma, you spoke about the end of history, and I've had to revisit Fukuyama's book, The End of History, and The Last Man, which I think is published in 1992. I think I mocked it at the time. I've had to reread it, and there's something very powerful and true there. He says, with the passage of communism from the world, the last universal alternative to liberal capitalism passes from the human imagination. So that doesn't mean there can't be anti-capitalist movements of one sort or another, but the last universal alternative to liberal capitalism passes from the world. And what he meant by that is that as much as he despised communism and socialism, he respected it as a worthy rival to capitalism. And he understood, he intuited that this was going to plunge the left into a crisis, which I think it does, quite a long crisis. Part of it is taken care of by a switch from a kind of Marxist or socialist left to an identity left of the 1990s and early decade of the 21st century. But here, the note I want to strike is that it's a profound moment of disorientation for the left, even among those people who were devout anti-communist leftists. Let me leave it at that now, and we can return to that later if you wish. But this makes an enormous difference to the triumph of neoliberalism, in part because of the ideological collapse of what had been the most spectacular experiment in radical anti-capitalist living, which is what the Soviet Union promised. And the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, also opens the world to capitalist penetration in a way that the world had not been open since prior to World War I. In other words, you got to go back to the late 19th, early 20th century to find global capitalism on a scale that is now possible once again in the 1990s. And that also gives the ideologues of capitalism a huge boost. The world is their oyster in a way in which it has not been for almost 100 years. Clinton comes into office with different sorts of ideas. There's a left wing to his administration, represented by Joe Stiglitz, The Economist, Robert Reich, George Stephanopoulos, up to a point. He's got this very ambitious healthcare plan, actually much more ambitious than the Obama plan that gets instituted in 2008, 2009. And then he gets slammed, roundly defeated over healthcare. He suffers the worst defeat of a sitting Democratic president in an off-year election in 1994 since 1946. He's observing and absorbing the consequences of the disappearance of communism from the world. He is seduced by the promise of the IT revolution that is gathering steam under his presidency. And he says the only way for the Democrats to survive in this world is for the Democrats to take the Republican ideas and appropriate them under Democratic guise. And he becomes an architect of the neoliberal order, and he passes legislation that in some ways outdoes Reagan in terms of opening the United States and the world to neoliberalism. He signs off on NAFTA. He signs off on the WTO in 1995. He passes what I consider to be one of the most important, if not the most important, law passed, or the second most important law in the 1990s, the deregulation of the telecommunications industry, which makes possible the feudalization of the information economy. And we live in that beast today. He signs off on the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, the separation of commercial from investment banking, which had been a key principle of the New Deal order. One of his last acts is he also signs off on a law permitting the non-regulation of derivatives, which is going to create so much trouble, leading to the financial crash of 2008-2009. This is all happening under a Democratic president, and it shows the degree to which Democrats either willingly or by compulsion felt compelled to embrace the neoliberal order as the only way for the Democratic Party to survive in a Republican era. One of the most interesting comments about this is Joe Stiglitz's reflections on this in his book On the Roaring 90s. He writes at one point, he says, John F. Kennedy in the early 60s went to Berlin and said, "We are all Berliners now." And Joe Stiglitz, who's very high up in the Clinton administration as an economic advisor in the 90s, says, sometime in the 1990s, we all became deregulators. Even me, you know, as progressive a voice in the Democratic administration as one could find, strong, really strong progressive commitments. And he confesses he doesn't quite know how it happened. He says, upon reflection, we should have fought this much more than we did at the time. But it shows you the powerful pull of these ideological forces that even an important figure on the left wing of the Clinton administration, upon reflection, felt he had gotten swept up into this way of thinking about the world.
And there's two other things that occur to me, too, is that one, everything you've just listed furthers a neoliberal structure to our economy, our government, and our society, he passes welfare reform, which is on some level a reflection of that, as much as it is, you know, imposing it back on our society. But it also occurs to me that this is a guy who came in with 45% of the vote. He didn't have even a majority of Americans, and there is an ascendant right wing machine at that point that includes, frankly, Rush Limbaugh, but extends to Newt Gingrich. And they, you know, on day one, they're talking about impeachment. And so, you know, he's the president of the party, or I should, president of the country, head of the party. But it was very much about his personal fortunes, too, that drove a lot of this.
Yes, yes. The attack on him and Hillary Clinton.
They called it Hillary Care, and that was very early on in the health care reform they attempted.
And yes, and I think Hillary Clinton once called it a vast right-wing conspiracy, a determination to delegitimate him as president and everything that he was doing. And also, Clinton was a political animal. And I mean that as a compliment, not as a cut at him. In other words, very sharp political antennae, very concerned about getting elected, getting other Democrats elected, having some durability in office. And so he was reading this situation, and he was reading all these things going against him, both personally and politically. I think part of the one of the questions I asked myself while I was writing this book was, if he's doing so much to implement the neoliberal agenda, why are the Republicans so mad at him? in important respect, he's doing their work for them. And I think part of it is related to him being a minority president, as you suggested. He's elected with 42 or 43% of the vote. If Ross Perot had not run in 1992, I believe that George H.W. Bush would have been reelected. The Republicans think they won the Cold War. They think they've defeated the New Deal. They think the world and America belongs to them. And here comes this intruder from this little Arkansas state, kind of white trash from their perspective, but very skilled at politics.
And you can see the Washington Post. I can't remember who it was in the Washington Post, but she was the publisher, or I don't know if it was I can't remember her name, but she would write that they're not of us. And that's, you know, coming out of the Clinton era, there was, at least with, you know, sort of like you'd see the online people talking about the village, and he was considered an interloper into that village. Well, let me jump ahead, because we don't have that much time left, but Bush and Obama, you perceive as basically winding down the neoliberal order, that Obama was the final president of the neoliberal order. We see, you know, Bush gets interventionist. He's trying to, although he did want to, you know, continue the liberalization of immigration. And Obama never has the progressive aspirations. And I think you'd also argue that he, because he knew he was faced with a financial crisis, probably larded up on the financiers in his administration more than he might have. Although I wonder about that, because I know that, like, Rubin was supportive of him, you know, much earlier, you know, earlier in that 2008, before anybody really accepted the magnitude of the crisis that was happening. And he famously got a list from Froman, who was one of those Citigroup executives, with, like, here's who you should appoint to your cabinet. And it was basically one for one. Froman ended up being the chief trade representative of the country, fashioned the TPP. So maybe the death of the TPP is one of the signifiers. This is the transatlantic, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was about as neoliberal as you can get in terms of, like, you know, making sure that we're going to have a industry is going to decide how these relationships happen amongst these different countries, and sovereign countries will lose a little bit of that sovereignty to this sort of corporate entity, essentially. And that has to be jettisoned, essentially, because Hillary Clinton can't win supporting that at that time. Let's talk about Trump a little bit, and then where we go from here, because Trump comes in. He is no more neoliberal, at least in the way that he projects himself, than arguably Bernie Sanders. I would argue, you know, the Bernie Sanders much less, but he represents something different ideologically than neoliberalism. What is that Trump represented?
Well, he's not beholden to a certain key neoliberal principles, which can be expressed in terms of what I sometimes call the four capitalist freedoms. These are not Roosevelt's four freedoms of 1941, but they are dear to the heart of a capitalist world and a capitalist enterprise, and that is free trade, free movement of people. You mentioned Bush's liberalizing immigration. That's actually fully in keeping with neoliberal principles, free movement of information and free movement of capital. And let's ask where Trump stands on these. He does not support free trade. He's protectionist. He makes protectionism. He and Bernie Sanders make protectionism and control of international trade a legitimate position in American politics for the first time in 30 years. Trump loathes the free movement of people. The reason that free movement of people is so central to the neoliberal promise is because it is meant to help globalization and efficient distribution of, in this case, human resources, and let people move to where they're going to move, where they can pursue their main chance, so to speak, or where capitalism can use them more effectively. He believes in building walls. He also believes deeply that in a certain racial view of America, privileging the Americans of European descent, and doesn't want immigrants from shithole countries. Neoliberalism is indifferent to where immigrants come from, as long as they can be fit into a capitalist framework. I think his attitudes toward free flow of information are more complicated, because he was the first Twitter president and used Twitter brilliantly to thrust himself and his face and his issues into the lives of 300 million Americans on a daily basis, got us all worrying about his latest tweet, what we were going to do when we saw that tweet first thing when rising in the morning. So he was not averse to using the information economy that had been created by high tech, but he was very critical of high tech companies and very embattled, and never shared Thomas Friedman's view of the world is flat and the instantaneous information being available every corner of the world at every moment of the day and night. Much more sympathetic to the authoritarians who want to have their own information spheres, China, Russia, Turkey, very partial to a world of regional blocks that don't partake of the promise of globalization. So if we measure him by his protectionism, if we measure him by his critique of the free flow of information, if we measure him by his ethno-nationalism and his determination to build walls, we can begin to see him moving America and its political economy in a somewhat different direction. Now, he was also, doesn't mean that elements of neoliberalism didn't survive in his presidency. He's very partial to corporations. Mike Pence was the Koch brothers' man in the White House in terms of forwarding the deregulation agenda. He never had high regard for government, and so was happy to see the deregulators installed at the head of many government agencies. So he does, in some respects, continue elements of neoliberal ideology, but he's profoundly threatening to the kind of globalized free market world of neoliberalism that had dominated through the Clinton years, through the Bush years, and I would say through the Obama years as well. And the fact that he and Sanders emerged from nowhere in 2016, utterly marginal players in American politics for decades, and suddenly are the two most dynamic players in American politics from 2016 going forward, it makes the 20-teens resemble the 1970s in some respects, when Milton Friedman and Hayek and others who had been utterly on the margins are suddenly given an opportunity to flow into the mainstream. Now, they're intellectuals and not politicians, but it's quite a similar phenomenon of ideas that have been consigned to the periphery moving to the center in a very powerful way. And this inclines me to think that the neoliberal order is cracked and that new ideas are now bidding for popular and elite support.
What scares me about what you're talking about in comparing it to the 1970s is it is unclear to me what the countervailing ideology was in the 70s to the neoliberalism. I mean, because by the time we get to the 80s, you've got Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman touring around, you know, with a monetized debate between yippies and yuppies. And on some level, like we, you know, Trump's the development of the authoritarian ethno-nationalism, white supremacy, this sort of amalgamation, that ideology, like I can point to half a dozen candidates, I guess, on the right, and maybe I can on the left as well. You know, maybe there is a nascent, you know, there's something is built there, but there's a lot more structure, superstructure supporting, you know, the Blake Masters or the J.D. Vance, who are sort of combining this. And I would add there's a certain like a religious authoritarianism and fundamentalism that is there as well on the right, as it were. What was there in the you know, to counterbalance in the 70s? And is there an analog today that you see?
You mean the counterbalancing against the neoliberal surge of the 90s?
Yeah, I mean, the neoliberalism was fight. There was a crisis. And people are searching around for a solution. Neoliberalism is there. It is, you know, it is being promoted, and there's a big machine behind it by that point in the 70s. We have the Heritage Foundation and the Powell memo calling for the money and for the sort of like the gunpowder to send this bullet into, you know, to create a trajectory. And I think we still have all those same moneyed forces, and they're getting behind this sort of authoritarianism on some level, and all of the sort of, you know, Trumpism or what Republicanism has evolved into. What was competing at that time, and what do you see competing today? Is there more? Is there a greater competition for this solution from the broader left than there was in the 70s?
Yeah, the left in American life has been reborn. And, you know, maybe the discussion we're having today and your show is partly evidence of that. It would have had a much more difficult time existing in the 1990s. Bernie Sanders, I consider him to be the second most important socialist in American history. Who's the first? There's my trivia question of the day,
Debs.
Sam. Who's the first?
Debs.
Yeah. Debs, 100 years earlier. I would say Sanders is the second most important socialist in American history. Let us not underestimate the magnitude of the victory of 2020 that Biden and Sanders and through their alliance achieved. And I would also say that progressivism has fared the best in American history when the left and center of the Democratic Party have been in productive dialogue. It was true of the progressive era, the Debsian era of the 19-teens. It was true of the New Deal era of the 1930s. It was true of the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And it is going on again today. And the dialogue between Biden and Sanders in the months leading up to and after Biden's election, very, very interesting, which led to the unveiling of a very ambitious progressive agenda. And what I said in the beginning when you asked of our conversation, when you asked me about political order, actually quite a number of elements of a progressive political order are in place. But it's also in terms of its constituency and of its electoral support is weak and vulnerable. And the greatest obstacle is not just the fire on the right, but it's the weakness of the Democratic Party in Congress. When Roosevelt was executing his transformational presidency of the 30s and 40s, he had huge majorities in both houses of Congress. And Biden is trying to do this without a majority in the Senate. I call Manchin a dino, Democrat in name only.
Sure.
He's not a Democrat. What can you do if you don't have a majority in the Senate? The answer is not much. But I don't think we should underestimate the significance of the rebirth of the left. And by the same token, if we go back to Obama for a moment and we try and imagine a different response of his to the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, when he came into office, if the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren led left had as much robustness in 2008 and 2007, 2008, as it did in 2015, 2016, as it did in 2019, 2020, the politics of 2008, 2009, the path chosen by Obama might have been different. Truth be told, he had no leverage of a left on his left that would have allowed him some more freedom of movement if he had wanted to move in a more left and progressive direction.
And there was nobody forcing him to as well.
Yes, I mean, I'm talking about a left with the capacity to compel him
right.
to turn left, as Sanders and Warren were able to compel Biden, not a noted leftist, to turn left in 2020 and 2021 with his package of proposals. So I just want to
reiterate, there is aspirational. And there is the actual power to do it. And in Biden, in my estimation, we have some people who disagree. That was his aspirations. You don't. If you're president, you don't say, "I'm going to jump 10 feet high," because you plan on jumping 6 inches. That's not what you do. You find that your legs just won't take you there.
Right. Right. And the distinction is an important one. But this is a moment, I think, of pessimism for Democrats and progressives. And I think it's important to take the longer view here and to remember the magnitude of the 2020 election and to think of, rather that being a flash in the pan, think of how can that be built on in years going forward. In other words, the struggle is not over. And if you were suggesting earlier that the authoritarian ethno-nationalist political order that might come out of this moment is far more firmly in place than the progressive order, I would agree with you. And I also think it's possible that America may lose its democracy in 2024, that a second coup attempt may not fail like the first one did. But I also believe that if America loses its democracy in 2024, there will be plenty of people who fight to get it back. It's important for progressives to go into this fight with some hope and belief that this struggle can be won. So I'm not disagreeing with you that the authoritarian ethno-nationalist political order is in some respects better placed, but the struggle is ongoing and has to be fought. And the history of progressivism in America is full of reversals. No one knew that better than Debs, and no one knows it better than Sanders. And I think it's important not to give up. It's important not to cede the struggle, not to cede the aspiration, because from aspiration can come at some point and under the right circumstances, accomplishment.
Gary Gersel, professor of American history at the University of Cambridge. The book is The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order, America and the World in the Free Market Era. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program. Really fascinating book and assessment and the way that ideas, I mean, this is a far field, but when I took religious studies, that's where you sort of learn, you look like study late antiquity. That's what I did. You see that, like, you know, you got to, like, 50 people. Oh, you got to go. Okay. 50 people, 50 different people at the time with a bunch of different ideas of what's going to be the religion that comes out of, let's say, the fall of the temple in Jerusalem around the year zero. You get a different type of Judaism, and then you get another different type of Judaism, which they call Christianity. And then, I don't know, a couple year, 100 years pass, you get Manichaeism grows and Islam. And there's 40 other different, you know, dudes out there. And I say dudes, maybe there were some women at the time too, but probably dudes who are like, no, it shouldn't be Islam. It should be, you know, Jimboism. My name is Jim. And
that's a real lost cause, is Jimboism.
Jimboism. But the point, Manichaeism, I can't pronounce it properly. There was this dude, Manny, who had a codex, and he had the whole thing, and was set up, and it just lasted a couple of hundred years. Shabbat, I can't remember the names of these guys, and I probably couldn't have pronounced it at the time. But the point is, there are a lot of ideas out there. And during times of crisis, these things get lifted off the shelf. And so, you know, I mean, I guess on some level, you know, like the professor said, we are, you know, part of that process. So, you know, 15 years ago, Janine and I are having this congressman from Vermont on, who is an independent. I don't even think, like, we would say socialist, but it was not like it just was still, we were in that era where you couldn't say socialist. And I remember having Bernie Sanders on and saying I would take 435 or 538 Bernie Sanders in our 435 in the House, maybe, I think I said at the time. That would be great. Then we had some, you know, there were some Democrats who were like, what? What is? So you push these ideas when you're out of power so that when the moment strikes, you're ready. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. We rely on our members for 92.3% of our revenue. And if you are someone who listens to the show or watches the show on a regular basis and want to help the show thrive and survive, become a member today. Join themajorityreport.com. Still have some people who have emailed us, don't have the financial resources to get the member show. Send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put into the subject line, fun half. You got to do that because we get so many emails that that's the way we search it. And then give us a little bit of time and we will work something out with you. And we're going to set up that, because many people keep emailing about it. We're going to set it up. I promise you will know about it when we set up a way for you to make a donation and support another member. A lot of people have asked about that. All right, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, for Left Reckoning patrons, yesterday we released, patreon.com/leftreckoning released an interview with Brett Scott, who is a financial journalist, who wrote a new book called Cloud Money about how Wall Street and Silicon Valley have been conspiring to come for your cash and move us towards a cashless society, and how that all that would have us all over a barrel and they'd just have control of us. So it's a dystopia. Patreon.com/leftreckoning if you want to know why it's cash and not crypto that should be the future.
I mean, on some level, it's sort of obvious.
Why they're doing it?
No, at some level, it's sort of obvious, like, why cash is actually a cashless society is ripe for more authoritarian control. Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, like, you don't know where that authoritarian control is going to come from, right? Like, you don't know if it's going to come from what we consider the government. I still, like, am stuck on this idea that when the Constitution was written, it was written about the concentration of power. It was an antitrust document. And that when Adam Smith talks about government, there was no democratically elected people at that time. So when he talks about government, God bless you, he's talking about monarchies. And that an elected government is a reflection of the people. And that having corporations that have dominant political power and economic power is like having a monarch. Key. Okay, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. and we'll take your IMs. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keene.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false. No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6.543 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.